What if AI could help your business deliver mission-critical outcomes with speed? With IBM Consulting, your business can design, build, and scale trusted AI using Watson X, and modernize the way you work to accelerate real impact. Let's create AI that transforms your business. Learn more at ibm.com/consulting. IBM. Let's create.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
Is getting gas at Shell burning a hole in your wallet? Get the Drop app. With Drop, you can earn free gift cards just by filling up your tank. Download Drop now. Use code DROP88 to instantly receive $5 in points.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher, back with another season of the global number one podcast, The Girlfriends. Last time, we investigated the murder of Gail Katz. This time, we're uncovering the identity of the woman who was buried in Gail's grave for a decade before she disappeared. Join me and the rest of the club as we tell her story. Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, listener mail. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and here we are bringing you some of the messages you've sent us over the past couple of weeks. Rob, if you're ready, I think we can jump right in. Do you mind if I read this one from Kate about our navigation episodes?
Make it so.
So in our three-parter on Pacific Island navigation, one thing we asked for was if any listeners had experience themselves with sailing, if they had thoughts about it. And so we did hear from someone. Kate wrote in to say, "Hello, Robert, Joe, and Seth. I'm writing in today in regards to the navigation episodes. I have multiple reasons this episode hit home, but I will try to keep it brief. First, I have the book you referenced throughout the series, and it is next on my reading list." I think she's talking about We the Navigators by David Lewis. But then second, I am a licensed day skipper, small sailboats, and also lived on a tall ship for 5 months and crossed the Atlantic. During this crossing, the second mate on board offered the opportunity to learn to navigate by the stars, and no one else took advantage of it, which was good in that it allowed me a solo course for our 21-day crossing, but also may say something of people's disinterest in something they don't directly require. The other thing I wanted to mention was that although there may have been specialized navigators, there would have been a massive amount of knowledge of the sea that would have been as commonplace as our understanding of a stop sign within today's society. The decline of this knowledge, it could be compared to even 50 years ago, when the majority of people were able to keep a decent sense of direction in the bush, or at least enough knowledge to stay on a path that they wouldn't get lost on, even if it wasn't a very noticeable path. Now, with the urbanization of humanity, there's considerably less common knowledge about bushcraft. It takes very little time for this information to be lost to a culture. Anyways, I really enjoy your shows, and my long drives to work are much more enjoyable when I have something to occupy my mind. Hope you're all well, Kate. Thanks, Kate. And yeah, one thing you say in here that I think is absolutely true and that sort of comes through in Lewis's book is that knowledge is a fragile thing, especially if you don't have a written culture. Like knowledge in an oral culture, it could take hundreds of years maybe to build up this vast store of wisdom and lore that's communicated from generation to generation. But if you don't have like written sources of it, it could easily be lost in just one generation.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, even of course in a written culture, even modern culture, there is still the risk of slipping into another dark age, and of course writers have been discussing this for pretty much as long as we've been out of the dark ages. So it's always worth keeping in mind. Now I like what Kate shared about knowledge of the bushcraft. Mm-hmm. This reminds me of our discussions on getting lost in the woods. I can't recall if those were different episodes or that was part of our look at the Leshy.
Oh, I think, yeah, it was in the Leshy and in some follow-up stuff we did about the Leshy.
Yeah, but just the idea that if you don't know anything about the woods, if you're you've just stuck to the path, you might well think that you can get off the path and easily return, that your sense of direction will guide you and will be something you can trust. And as we discussed in that episode, experiments have shown that humans do not have that innate ability. If you don't know what you're doing, leaving the path can be fatal.
Yes, and of course that varies a lot with like individual skill in the local terrain. Mm-hmm. You know, some places are easier to get lost than others, but there are these stories that we did discuss in the Leshy episode about, yeah, people go, you know, they think they're just going 10 or 20 feet off the path to go to the bathroom, and then suddenly like they have no idea where they are and they can't find the path again.
Yeah.
So I'd say that together with the Pacific Navigation episodes just should make you to keep in mind, appreciate direction finding and appreciate the tools and the resources you have, appreciate the skills people have in that area. It's very valuable and is something we often take for granted.
Absolutely. All right, this next one comes to us from Ian. Ian writes in and says, "Dear Rob and Joe, I am still writing in about robot punishment, despite it having been a couple of weeks since I listened to it. In that episode, you mentioned in passing that humans often have less conscious control of our actions than we like to believe. This has come up in other episodes as well, specifically the one you did about how our choices affect our preferences instead of the other way around. I meditate daily, a practice that, among other things, can be looked at as a way to gain more conscious control of your actions, emotions, and even your thoughts. Of course, this is easier said than done. I wrote most of this email in my head this morning while attempting to clear my mind of all thoughts." I've certainly been there. It got me thinking about the rider and the horse analogy and the criticism that this view separates the mind and body in a way that isn't justified. We are inherently embodied beings. You have also discussed this idea, which I believe, Rob saying we are more like a centaur, which I like. However, I wonder if it isn't more apt than we give it credit for. The common way the analogy is explained is that people think of the mind as a rider in command of a horse, the body. But consider that in reality, a human rider isn't actually in command of the horse they're riding as much as they might like to think they are. Sound familiar? A human is not strong enough to actually make the horse do anything it doesn't want to do. All the human can do is create incentives and disincentives to try to encourage the horse to behave in the way the human desires. But ultimately, it is still the horse that is deciding what it will do. And I think this is a valid point. I mean, certainly in meditation and meditative practices, sometimes your body is a bit barn sour, you know? Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's in a bit too much of a hurry to get out of the wilds and back to, the sweet hay of the barn. Anyway, Ian continues. "Even though our consciousness isn't in charge of our actions like we think it is, and it's mostly post facto explanation, perhaps it evolved as an incentive system to train our other mental processes. For instance, it may be my emotions and other lower mental processes that determine whether I have that second piece of cake, but maybe those are influenced by my conscious thoughts, or at least the conscious thoughts I've had in the past. Perhaps my doctor has told me I need to cut back on sugar, but at the last birthday party I decided to have a second piece of cake anyway, and then upon reflection felt guilt about having done so, which changes the emotional calculus this time. As you've mentioned before, evolution is stingy, and expensive things like mental processes don't tend to stick around unless they serve a purpose. Perhaps this is that purpose. So maybe the horse and rider idea isn't so bad after all. We're just drawing the line in the wrong place. Maybe instead of the rider being the mind and the horse being the body, the rider is our consciousness and the horse is the rest of our mental, emotional, and bodily processes. The rider thinks they're in charge, but really, they're just one influence on the horse among many. As an aside, this brings up another way this analogy works well, the feeling of loss of control when very upset. I'm sure we all have experienced being so upset that we act entirely on our emotions while simultaneously experiencing the conscious part of ourselves watching our actions and thinking, stop, I shouldn't be doing this, but being unable to actually stop ourselves. I suppose this would be akin to the horse bucking and the rider not being able to do much besides hold on. To go back to my original thoughts about meditation, perhaps the way that helps us gain control is by teaching us to be a horse whisperer. We're still without true control of the horse, but it helps us be a heck of a lot better at motivating it to do what we want. Ian.
Ian, I think this is a fantastic analogy. I mean, and I think there are truths to both methods here. I mean, Rob, in your analogy of the centaur, you're emphasizing that you can't make a clear distinction between the brain and the body. The body influences the brain. Of course, the brain influences the body, but it goes the other way too. You know, they're inherently connected, and trying to think about them as like two separate things leads to some confusion. But I think Ian also has a very good point here.
Yeah, I love all of this. But also, I can't help but be reminded of the most recent episode of Weird House Cinema where we discussed Spontaneous Combustion starring Brad Dourif, because that is, as we discussed, it's a film about an individual who has trouble controlling his emotions. And when his emotions are out of control, fire erupts from his body, from the world around him, from bits of technology, etc. And he seems to have very little, if any, control over these flames. And the flames are indiscriminate in who and what they burn. So I feel like that is kind of a proper analogy for some of this as well. You know, this idea of loss of control, stop, I shouldn't be doing this. Because once the fire is out, the fire does what fire does. It burns. And what can you do but watch?
Very apt. All John Landis's take note. But I would also say that I can see some merit to Ian's other point. So Ian is, I think, sort of making a case against epiphenomenalism. You know, so epiphenomenalism is one take on the mind-body problem that would tend to say that actually consciousness does nothing. I mean, consciousness exists, and it is the part of your brain that can reflect upon itself. But your brain could do everything it does without being conscious. Consciousness is just some sort of strange byproduct, maybe, that we don't understand, but it doesn't actually have power over anything. And epiphenomenalism would be something that's difficult to demonstrate. But here, I think Ian is sort of equating consciousness with having some kind of reinforcing power on the metacognition of the brain in order to influence the future behavior of the brain, saying that the consciousness actually does play this role in metacognition that helps us better rein in our own mental processes. And I guess that's possible, but it's hard to know. I can't recall who's written like this before, but I know I have encountered this idea that in some ways basically sees consciousness as necessary to or coextensive with metacognition.
So it remains an open question. Is the human mental condition, is it a centaur? Is it a rider on a horse? Is it a character actor on fire? Is it a satyr? I don't know. You can go in various directions.
All right. Oh, and so also apologies to Ian. I had to make some abridgments to the previous email for length. Apologies to the next writer, because Sean, I also had to make some abridgments to this email as well. I'm sure you all understand. But Sean writes to us about... Sorry.
What? No, I was just thinking we told everybody not to say they're sorry for writing a long email, but now we're apologizing for carving up long emails.
Well, okay, no, so I don't usually mention if I just cut out like a line here or there at the beginning or end that's just sort of introductory material or whatever, but if I have to chop out like huge paragraphs or something, I might note it just so the writer doesn't believe I missed it by accident.
Okay.
But maybe me saying this now means I won't have to say it in the future. Yeah, sometimes, folks, I'm just going to have to edit emails down a bit. Anyway, thank you very much, Ian. And then Sean gets in touch with us about finger counting and frisson. Sean says, "Hi, Joe, Robert, and Seth. Someone might have written in to tell you this already, but I have a method of counting to 33 on one hand. I first learned this method from my late father-in-law, who was teaching me how to make thicker." Well, okay, so the word here is spelled D-H-I-K-R or D-H-I-K-I-R. I've heard it pronounced thicker before, but Sean gives a pronunciation guide in which he says to pronounce it thickier, which might be like a regional language variation, I'm not sure. But since Sean gives that, I'm going to say thickier instead of thicker for the rest of the email. So in thickier here, which is an Islamic practice of praying... Sean says, the first time he showed me how to count this way on one hand, I nodded along, but really it took a long time before I understood. I'll try to describe the method. Imagine each finger split into four sections. The fingertip, then each crease where there is a joint. By placing your thumb before the first joint crease of a finger, you can count to one. Then after that same crease makes two. Continue up the finger, counting up one both before and after each crease. Finally, counting one when you reach the fingertip. This makes a total of a count of seven for each finger. You can do the same with the index finger on the thumb, counting to a total of five, as there are only two joint creases in the thumb. 4 times 7 plus 5 makes a total of 33 for one hand. This is useful for the thikir, as each mantra should be said 33 times. However, I can't imagine many other situations in which you need to count to a base 33. I'm sure if one has been learning to count this way since childhood, it would be easier to remember, but after learning this method as a second language, I doubt I'll ever be able to master it for day-to-day needs. Technically, with mastery of this counting method, you could count the single digits on one hand up to 33, then count orders of magnitude on the other hand again up to 33, so theoretically one could count up to 1,089, or 33 times 33, with just two hands.
That's impressive.
Absolutely. I'd never heard about this before. But then Sean goes on. Sean says, changing topic, I wanted to offer my experience of frisson. I noticed while listening to an episode of Listener Mail that you were talking about the backing vocals of Gimme Shelter, and I experienced a wave of goosebumps. I first heard these particular vocals in the original frisson episode, and they triggered frisson in me, but it was unexpected that a mere description of the vocals would trigger it too. I often experience musical frisson as well as a similar sensation in emotional movies or podcasts, and sometimes while just thinking about an emotional story or movie scene. All the best, Sean.
Now, that does make me wonder when Sean is thinking about these particular musical bits, are they playing out in their head, you know? Because mm-hmm. I find that, like, that's the case for me. Like, if someone was to mention, say, like the very opening of Radiohead's Everything in Its Right Place, or to say, hey, how about that really dramatic part of Carmina Burana, which dramatic part, but if there's enough of a hook there, then I do replay it in my mind, and then I can certainly feel a certain amount of chills. You know, I can experience goosebumps if it is the right song.
Yeah. Parts of Les Mis for me, I think, will do that.
Yeah.
I'm not sorry.
No. Les Mis is a good musical. I got to see it once. It had the big wheel stage.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, like with the barricades treadmill. Coming. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's a good way. You know, that actually powers the whole theater. It's just the pure acting energy of the cast and crew.
They've got little Gavroche on a hamster wheel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Ever tried to tackle a home improvement project without making 10 trips to Home Depot? What if I told you there's a way to earn cash back while you shop? Introducing Drop, the ultimate rewards app. With Drop, you can earn free gift cards by shopping in-store or online at Home Depot and tons of other stores. Download the Drop app today and use code DROP33 to get an instant $5 in points. That's Drop, your go-to for shopping rewards.
This is Amy Brown from Four Things with Amy Brown. Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways that healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
All right, here's one from Taylor. This comes as a response to our episode on queuing. Robert and Joe, great episode on waiting. It finally prompted me to write after years listening consistently since the How Stuff Works days. In the waiting episodes, I'd be curious to hear more of our tendency to wait or follow orderly lines when there is no line or correct order. For example, in New York City, when hailing a cab, there's always the situation where a cab can pull over, but it takes time for it to stop, so he overshoots you by a few feet. Innately, people understand that the cab pulled over for me from the line of, I was earlier in the street, so he saw me, even if they may be closer to where he finally stopped. So we make a line of where you are in the street, even though there isn't an actual line.
I think I understand that.
You should prove this nuance how we innately create unwritten laws by labeling the show The Waiting Part 4, only to a week later have a The Waiting Part 3 for 30 seconds when you point out many people probably waited patiently for a Part 3 before listening to Part 4 because that's what people do. Great show, Taylor.
I love this guidance on how to screw with listeners' heads.
Yeah, I feel like we're doing enough of that. Without trying to. So I don't know if we need to orchestrate anything too sinister here.
But Taylor, I do think that's interesting about the understanding of the unspoken queuing rules for cabs on the New York City streets, especially since there's this cultural meme or reputation for like people in New York being like rude and pushy and selfish and just trying to get ahead of everything. I mean, for one thing, we saw plenty of opposition to that in those Stanley Milgram experiments, which were carried out in New York City, or at least around the New York City area. But also, I think that's, you know, to whatever extent that's true, it clearly doesn't extend to people not obeying lines. Like, you know, lines dominate even when everybody's really got to get a cab.
Yeah, I mean, if things get too out of hand, though, what we're going to have to do is just make everybody roll for initiative. That's just the only way to handle it. Let's get those dexterity rolls out here. Let's see what we get on a D20, and we will rank everybody accordingly, and you will know exactly what order you go in.
All right, this next listener wanted to remain anonymous, but they write in concerning queuing at a place where I have experienced some of the most nerve-wracking lines and wait times ever, which is at border crossing checkpoints. You ever have this experience, Rob?
Yeah, I mean, going through customs at the airport, that sort of thing.
Yeah, that kind of thing, yeah. Mm-hmm. So this anonymous listener says, I currently live in Chula Vista, California, and I crossed almost religiously to Tijuana for family and business. One of the biggest fight starters that always happens at the border are those who cut in line via car or foot. Fights and arrests happen weekly, especially people who cross without appropriate documentation, such as spring breakers or weekend drunks. There are people who cross daily because of work or school, and there's always people who don't respect the line, and when you least expect it, a fight breaks out, and the cops show up, and then the border has to close for a while until everything is calmed down. People are always in a rush, there aren't enough CBP officers, and the lines have taken from 2 minutes to 4 hours on foot, and 10 minutes to 10 hours via car. This is through my own experience crossing through the port at San Ysidro. Thanks for taking the time to read my email. And man, this one, well, thank you for getting in touch, but also this one makes me think about some of the downsides of the single file queuing for access to things, where there are like wildly different stakes for different queuers. So you have somebody like the person riding in here who probably has to cross the border frequently, maybe every day for work and family and stuff like that. And then at the same time, like the same queues are being shared by like drunk tourists who are just partying.
I can't believe I didn't bring this up, but this reminds me of a form of queuing that I have really appreciated in the, I guess, few establishments that I found it integrated, and that is the idea of having two lines, the I know what I want line and the I need some help line.
Oh, that's like smart. Yeah.
That can really move things along. You know, if you know exactly what you're getting, let's go back to our bagel sandwich analogy. If you just know you're getting the number three, no changes, whatever, then yeah, let's have a line for those people. But if you need to inquire about changes to the menu, about the ingredients, if you need some guidance on which bagel sandwich to order, then yes, let's have a separate line for that. And we can have a specialized teller that deals with those clientele.
Yeah. I mean, it may be the case that some border checkpoints have something like this. I don't know. But I mean, if they don't, you should find a way to organize things into, you know, one line for people who have business and family obligations. And then the other, all the spring breakers and stuff, they get their own line.
Yeah. But I guess that one of the challenges is just anytime you get into a system like that, how do you do it in a way that's fair for everybody?
Right. Yeah.
All right, here's another one. This one comes to us from Chris, dear Robert, and Mr. Joe. Listen,
okay.
Mr. Joe. The only person I think I've introduced you to as Mr. Joe is my son. But it's okay, I guess, if other people call you Mr. Joe. Listener from the Science Lab days, thanks for years of podcast. Stuff from the Science Lab was, of course, the original name of this podcast way back in the day when I co-hosted it with Allison Loudermilk. Anyway, Chris continues. Queuing. I had an experience with queuing yesterday that I thought I'd ride in with. I was at the county clerk's office to get a title for my car. The queuing system was a paper system. You would get a number and have a waiting area. The wait was long, an hour and a half, and during that time I saw a couple of things you may be interested in. First off, several people left after waiting for a while. This meant their number was getting unused. What is the morality of taking their number? I didn't get the chance as they threw it out while leaving, but would it be cutting in line? I don't think anyone would have noticed. They were too busy looking at their phones. What would that change the morality of it? Second, in a system where it is easy to understand once you understand what the system is, what is your responsibility as a line waiter to communicate with others who are trying to understand the system? In a normal queue, people point out the line and the end of the line for the person, I think, to make sure the system is orderly for their own convenience. In this case, someone stood waiting where you would get called up, as if there were a regular queue. Do you tell them or let them learn to pay attention? Perhaps allowing a person or two to grab a number in front of them as a lesson? It felt like it was an easy system. I had seen many people figure it out before her. Or am I just being rude because I don't like to talk to people? Anyhow, great podcast. Thanks, Chris.
Well, on the first question, I think, yes, taking the number of someone who has – there's actually a technical term for this in the queuing literature. It's known as balking. People who look at a line or look at a queuing system and then just say like, okay, the service or product I want is not worth whatever this waiting or queuing situation is, and they just leave. That's called balking. So somebody balks, they've already got a number, they they do a late balk and then they leave. If you take their number, yes, you are violating the first in, first out principle there. So I would say that is cutting. I'd say the only real variation on that is if somehow an abandoned number took as much time as a like an actual customer. But usually an abandoned number just means like they call it out, nobody comes, and they go to the next one, right?
Yeah, I never really thought about this before because generally I don't think I've ever seen anyone say, "Hey, I'm leaving. I'm out of here. Who wants my number?" It's generally just discarded, or maybe they might sort of casually leave it out. I don't know, but I guess I could see a case going either way, kind of a gray area. Now this idea of balking, it's interesting because I heard an NPR story recently about balking in terms of reservations for restaurants, which especially during this time when restaurants are opening up, often from very slim down models of operation. Mm-hmm. And you have people do something that can make a lot of sense on the consumer end. You're not sure if you're going to eat at this restaurant or not, but you're going to go ahead and get a reservation. Maybe mm-hmm. you'll go ahead and get two reservations for restaurants that are close to each other and see how you feel when you get closer to the time. And of course, that may give you a lot of options, but it takes options away from the restaurant that's trying to to run a business. And so they were talking about how some places are turning this model of requiring you, in order to make a reservation, you have to pay a small fee, mm-hmm. which I have done. I was kind of surprised when that came up. I was like, oh wow, this place thinks they're fancy, but they weren't that fancy. And after I heard this radio story, it made a lot more sense. It's like, yeah, you want people to have an investment in actually following up on that reservation.
As somebody who has worked in restaurants, people don't do this. This is so annoying to the staff that works at the restaurant. It can mean lost business, of course, but it also is just like a huge pain in the neck for like the host or whoever's managing the seating. And a lot of restaurants, they have like cycles of giving the tables to the different servers. So like you might have a server who's getting skipped in one cycle of seating because they know they've got a big party coming next with a reservation. But then if that party doesn't show up, they're just out that table and out the tip. Mm-hmm. It screws things up for everybody. It's extremely rude. Don't do that.
Yeah.
Sorry, I didn't mean to get a two-finger waggy there, but
I
know it from the other end.
Yeah. I mean, and from the consumer end, like, it sucks to try and get a reservation somewhere and you can't, or you show up at a place and you can't get a table. So help reduce the number of, of ghosts that have reservations, people right. that are never going to show up.
Okay, one last message here. This is in response, I think, to a previous listener mail episode and generally to Weird House Cinema. This is from Megan. Megan says, "Hello, I've been an avid listener for many years now, and I love the addition of Weird House Cinema. In your recent listener mail episode, you were discussing why nuclear radiation is depicted as a green glow rather than a more realistic blue glow. Something you didn't discuss was a fact I learned while getting my film studies degree, a fact that I can't unsee ever since I learned it. In film, the use of green often foreshadows death. For example, if a character is bathed in green light during a tense scene, the outcome is usually not good for that character. Maybe the use of green to depict radiation glow is also related to this cinematic shorthand, since radioactive substances can lead to illness or death. Anyways, keep your eyes peeled for this in movies. It is surprising how often a character's demise can be forecast by the color green being subtly added to the character in some way. Thanks for all you do. Stuff to Blow Your Mind is the metric by which I measure all other podcasts." Megan. Oh, that's sweet. Thank you, Megan. Yeah, this is interesting. I think maybe I'd heard this before, but it's definitely never been front of mind for me.
Yeah, I guess it's something I need to look out for next time I sit down and watch a film. But it does bring to mind, I was looking at different Brad Dourif clips for our recent Weird House Cinema mm-hmm. episode, and I ran across one of those just unnecessarily grotesque scenes from David Lynch's Dune mm-hmm. that features Clan Harkonnen sitting around grossing it up, and it has these just just disturbingly green walls in the background. You know the scene I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah. The very first time we meet the Harkonnens. You got Baron Harkonnen there. Like, I think he ends up like floating around the room. Mm-hmm. But it's Brad Dourif has Peter DeVries there. And mm-hmm. what is Sting in the room?
I think Fade Rotha is there. Also, the Beast is there and the various Raban, underlings. Yeah. So it's the whole crew just hanging out in the Harkonnen
the evil redheads.
Yeah.
Yeah, but they're hanging out and the room is just green. It is just leprechaun green.
Yeah, shockingly green. Like, green enough that by modern standards, you look at it and you're like, is this a finished scene? Were they going to add something digitally in the background? And you're like, no. I think that, no, this is before all that. This is just a really green color choice for their wall.
Do I recall that also in Lynch's Dune, when you see the Harkonnen planet, it's sort of green on the outside too, but not like a... not like a natural green, like trees and foliage and all that, but it's just like green buildings.
Hmm. That sounds familiar, but I don't recall. It's been a while since I've seen it in full.
Well, it's quite appropriate. Harkonnen means death.
Yeah.
And I think by the end of the movie, are all those characters dead? I believe they are. I don't know what happens to the Beast. But
I think the Beast dies, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Spoiler for Dune, sorry.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, these bad guys are all doomed, but they cause a lot of havoc before that comes around. So, good old Clan Harkonnen. All right, we're going to go ahead and close the mailbag here, but we will be back. So keep writing in. We didn't get to everything in this episode, as usual, but we'll come back to it. So write in with your thoughts about navigation, about emotional outbursts and centaurs on fire, more listener mail about Harkonnens and waiting in line. We'd love to hear all of it. Let's see. Yes, if you want to hear listener mail, it occurs on Mondays. Artifact occurs on Wednesdays. Weird House Cinema occurs on Fridays. And Tuesdays and Thursdays, those are our core episodes of Stuff to Boil Your Mind.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Is getting gas at Chevron burning a hole in your wallet? Get the Drop app. With Drop, you can earn free gift cards just by filling up your tank. Download Drop now. Use code DROP77 to instantly receive $5 in points.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher, back with another season of the global number one podcast, The Girlfriends. Last time, we investigated the murder of Gail Katz. This time, we're uncovering the identity of the woman who was buried in Gail's grave for a decade before she disappeared. Join me and the rest of the club as we tell her story. Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
A new season of Bridgerton is here. And with it, a new season of Bridgerton, the official podcast. I'm your host, Gabby Collins. And this season, we are bringing fans even deeper into the ton. Watch season three of the Shondaland series on Netflix. Then fall in love all over again by listening to Bridgerton, the official podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to catch a new episode every Thursday.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy. Yeah. Right?
Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.